it's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Halloween, and we'll delve into the history of one of the country's most popular holidays.
First, a new Milwaukee Journal Sentinel report is looking at where the major party presidential candidates stand on various issues that affect us here in Wisconsin. Everything from dairy industry issues to programs for senior citizens.
Jason Stein joins us now to tell us more about each campaign's response. He covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Hi, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, the Journal Sentinel posed questions to the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign that were looking at mostly regional issues here in Wisconsin that you felt weren't necessarily being covered thoroughly by national media. Can you tell us broadly what were some of those questions?
Right. So I looked at things like the senior care prescription drug program, which is really unique to Wisconsin, the Great Lakes, the dairy industry, manufacturing, things that wouldn't be covered at all by national media or might not be covered in as much depth.
And did anything surprise you that you found out?
Yeah, a couple things. One with each candidate. One, in the case of senior care, when she was a Democratic presidential primary candidate here in Wisconsin in 2008, Hillary Clinton said that she would support renewing the federal waiver for the senior care program, which is a Wisconsin-level alternative to Medicare Part D prescription drug program for seniors. Only Wisconsin has a program like this. This time around, she praised the aspects of senior care but hedged on whether she would continue that program when it comes up for renewal in 2018. And then there was something on the Trump side related to taxes.
All right. Well, let's dig into some of those things you mentioned there, starting with the milk income loss contractor. I guess it's known as MILC. Can you first tell us what that is and how responses have varied over different political cycles?
Sure. I mean, one thing that's been interesting is in the past that program, or just in general dairy subsidies, you saw candidates really being willing to talk to the dairy industry in the state and talk about subsidies. You had George W. Bush come to Northwest Wisconsin in 2004 to really announce this program called the Milk Income Loss program, that he would extend it, and that was something that delivered a lot of money into Wisconsin's dairy program. You know, this time around, neither candidate would commit to renewing the successor to the MILC, which is this called the Dairy Margin Protection Program.
So in terms of dairy policy in general, did you learn anything there?
You know, I mean, I think one thing, one sort of takeaway is that I think politicians seem to play a little bit less, today at least, this version of, promising certain federal funds to certain regions of the country or certain industries. At least that, I think, has become more problematic in politics today than it might have been, you know, say in 2004. It's hard to imagine at least a Republican candidate making the sort of commitment that President Bush made in 2004.
And let's go back and look at senior care, which you mentioned earlier was a surprise for you. This is a prescription drug program for seniors in the state, and that Hillary Clinton would not firmly say she was on board with that again for the future. What did you find out for Donald Trump?
Right. So in that case, Donald Trump as well did not commit to renewing it. A little different in that other Democratic candidates like President Obama have committed to renewing that in the past. One thing that surprised me about the Trump campaign was they said that they cited something on their website saying that a Wisconsin family of roughly median income, or a family with income roughly the median in Wisconsin, could see a 35% tax decrease under his plan. That seemed very large to me, and when I looked into it, I found at least one academic who felt that it could be far less than that in practice for families with two kids.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now. He covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're looking in specific at Wisconsin-focused questions that the Journal Sentinel posed to both Hillary Clinton's campaign and Donald Trump's. And let's get into taxes, because that is an area a policy area where both candidates have had quite a lot to say. You were looking there at Donald Trump. Flesh that out for us. What did Donald Trump say about how his tax plan would affect Wisconsin?
Right. I mean, again, essentially, what his campaign has said on their website is that there would be a 35% tax cut for a family making $50,000 a year, two kids, and $8,000 a year in child care expenses. One academic at New York University, who tax attorney who formerly worked in the Obama administration, did a similar analysis and said that in reality, there would be less than a 1% tax decrease for that family. And what she argues is that the Trump campaign is not fully taking into account how much their own changes to deductions for family members, whether it's head of household, child tax credit, child tax deductions, those things will play out for families in the real world when it comes time to file.
And what did you find out about the Clinton camp and what her plan would do for Wisconsin families when it came to taxes?
Right. I mean, the Clinton campaign camp is a little easier to summarize their tax plan, because essentially her plan involves raising a variety of taxes that would impact upper income earners. So, you know, there's one change that would affect income earners above $1 million, another one that would affect individuals making more than $3 million in a year, and she has argued that at least in theory her plans would not impact people below $250,000 of income in a year. So it's a little easier to summarize that. Obviously, Republicans are going to argue that by having an effect on the economy, you know, there could be some sort of fallout for families that are below that income level.
And in terms of the cost inferred by each of the tax plans, what do we know?
Right now, nonpartisan organizations like the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget have said that Hillary Clinton's plan would add $200 billion to the deficit over 10 years, which might sound like a lot to your listeners. Obviously, the federal government does, however, spend and take in a lot of money. They've said that Donald Trump's plan, mainly because it involves the largest tax cut of any presidential candidate in this cycle, would impact by trillions of dollars, an increase to the federal debt, they say, on the order of $5 trillion.
Now, transportation funding has been a really hot topic here in Wisconsin. It's not just an issue in Wisconsin. It's an issue nationally, but here in Wisconsin, it's of great interest. So what did you find out about what the candidates would say about roads and infrastructure?
Right. We asked them specifically something that in Wisconsin you see state leaders sometimes talk about putting in place tolling. It's not necessarily something that would be popular, but it would be a way of raising more money to fill a shortfall in our state transportation fund without having to raise taxes or cut road projects. The issue there is that for most situations, you would need federal approval of Congress and the president to institute tolling lanes. So I asked both presidential candidates if they'd be willing to sign off on that, and not surprisingly, perhaps, both of them ducked it.
And Jason, you've been following this presidential campaign, covering parts of it. How resonant do you think these specific policy issues are to voters in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, I can just say at a personal level that in some ways it seems more futile to me as a reporter to write about these issues. People's passions seem so inflamed this election cycle that in some ways it doesn't feel like anyone is going to change their vote or have their vote affected by anything I write. On the other hand, I do think that, you know, one way or another, one of these two candidates is going to become president, and I think it is worthwhile trying to nail him or her down on as many of these issues that affect our readers and our residents of the state as we can while the election is still going on.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, thanks, Veronica.
That was Jason Stein, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out why smart people turn stupid at businesses, schools, and other organizations. We'll talk about the stupidity paradox.
Right now. It is October 31st. If you haven't checked your calendar, if you poke your head outside this evening, you'll see goblins, ghouls, Star Wars characters, and maybe some presidential candidates wandering around, knocking on doors, asking for treats, maybe playing the occasional trick.
And while Halloween is seen as a goofy, family-friendly holiday in the United States, the roots of the holiday go back thousands of years.
Joining us now to talk about the history of Halloween is Tim McMahon. He's an associate professor of history at Marquette University, and he's the vice president of the American Conference for Irish Studies. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Well, it looks like I did a little reading up. Halloween goes back a lot of years. This is not a recent invention of the candy companies.
Absolutely not. Well, the way we celebrate it or recognize it in the U.S. now, I think, is more a product of the candy companies. But you know, if you go back to its earliest roots, it's associated with a Celtic festival called Samhain, which, you know, most Americans would look at that word on a piece of paper and think it is pronounced Samhain, but it's pronounced Samhain, and essentially it means the end of summer. Right, it's the end of the harvest. The days are getting shorter, and it's this sort of liminal time when you know, the dead may walk, because you know, the season of life is coming to an end, and the long winter is coming.
And Tim, what did the ancient Celts do to celebrate or to observe, I guess, Samhain?
Well, thanks, Veronica. Among other things that were associated with Samhain, they of course feared that the spirits that might be walking, and so it was not unusual to leave out some sort of food or sustenance outside your door to protect yourself. But it also was not unusual to light fires. That's actually something that is common right down to the present time. For example, in Ireland, you'll often find fires lit in communities at Halloween. I mean, if you go back a few hundred years, it was not unusual in, say, a village in rural Ireland for people to put out their the fire in their hearths, and then go to a communal bonfire in the village, and then come home at the end of that with a spark from that fire and relight their home fire from the communal thing. So kind of uniting with your neighbors in that way. But, you know, all kinds of traditions were built up around it, from, you know, divination, you know, how to find out who your spouse will be, to games and trickery, you know, that ultimately would evolve into what we know today.
And eventually Christianity came along to these Celtic lands. What was the tension between Halloween and the festivities you mentioned and the church, maybe not liking some of those superstitions?
Sure. You know, I mean, one of the things that I think we have to realize about a lot of holidays that we celebrate now is that they were kind of superimposed. You're talking about different cultural systems and different cultural structures that ultimately are blended. You know, I talk with my students a lot about the concept of what I call syncretic Christianity, that in essence, a lot of the Christian holidays are built onto these almost pre-existing calendar customs. So, you know, when I think it was Pope Gregory VIII in the middle of the 700s, you know, basically declared, you know, November 1st to be All Saints' Day, right? So essentially recognizing the dead in a Christian fashion at the same time, or roughly the same time, that Samhain would have been recognized on an old Celtic calendar. But you also, I mean, even before Christianity, the Roman Empire had sort of a Day of the Dead at roughly the same time. So these all end up kind of blending together. And what we call Halloween is, you know, All Hallows Eve, so the night before All Saints. A lot of the traditions, the sort of dressing up maybe in a mask to ward off the evil spirits that are walking, that one might have seen in a Samhain festival, becomes more regularized as a Halloween tradition.
And in that same vein of sort of Christian holidays and observances being superimposed on pagan ones, there was an interesting little historical tidbit about how there was a switch made from putting out food and wine for departed souls to using soul cakes. Do you know about soul cakes?
This was more of an English tradition or a Scottish tradition, but soul cakes is, as I recall, had to do with when the poor especially would come to the house on Halloween, you would offer them these cakes in exchange for their prayers, especially for dead family. In that sense, building in a Christian ritual, i.e. praying for the dead, into this prior tradition where, you know, people who were walking about for a Samhain festival might have been taking goods from your house. Yeah.
Talking to Tim McMahon, Associate Professor of History at Marquette University, looking at the history of today. Halloween goes back a couple thousand years, it sounds like. Let's bring it up to the modern day, or closer to, Tim. Here in the United States, when did Halloween first take off as an American tradition?
Well, it was really a product of people moving to the new U.S. I think the closest that we get to where we are today really is sort of the mid 19th century, especially when you see waves of Irish coming to the U.S. In the wake of the potato famine. But you also already had immigrants coming from other parts of the United Kingdom, and indeed other parts of Europe, where there had been similar harvest traditions. But the idea of, again, moving from house to house, dressed in costume, and either offering a trick or warding off you doing a trick in exchange for something to eat, it became part of the tradition around October 31st. And then really when you move into the 20th century, there was kind of the element that again you saw back, let us say, in Ireland, where, you know, as recently as the 1970s in Ireland, it was not unusual for, you know, groups of young men especially to go through towns playing tricks on people, dropping fireworks in mailboxes and that kind of thing. And into the 1920s and 30s in the U.S., you saw that kind of thing too. And so gradually over time, communities basically started to regularize and police it, and then ultimately turn it into more of a children's or a family holiday, and that really takes off with the baby boom once you get past 1950 or so, when you've got just this huge number of young people and mass marketing, especially for children and families at that point in time.
It's obviously still a really big deal. I've got two kids who are probably just dying to get out there already tonight. But do you think that Halloween is also, it seems like it's growing. It seems like it's not just kids and their parents. It seems like, you know, young people in their 20s and 30s really love getting dressed and buying costumes and going out. So do you think it's still kind of evolving?
I do. I mean, I think anytime you've got a cultural tradition or a legacy that goes from generation to generation, every age group is going to put its own spin on things. I mean, I think that's true throughout history. And in the U.S., especially, there's a great driver of that, and that's money. if there's money to be made, someone's going to sell the costumes. Someone's going to, you know, market the talking skull that you'll see on your porch front tonight. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's fun. I mean, all you need to do is to look at the costume shops and the malls and so forth, and you realize absolutely you're right. It's not just marketed to kids; it's marketed to people of all ages. And you know, I mean, I'm looking forward to going home and distributing candy tonight in our neighborhood just because I think it's one of my favorite nights of the year.
And you mentioned, we've talked about how a lot of this came originally from Ireland. How does the modern day, today's Irish Halloween celebration compare to ours? What might surprise an American trying to do Halloween in Ireland?
Well, I mean, I think it's actually more, in my experience, which is limited at this time of year. But I mean, I was there over a holiday, a Halloween, in the mid-90s, and while you certainly saw a lot of kids dressed up in costumes, it was more, teens and young adults, I think, on the street, with elements of mischief making. And I don't think that's entirely bad, though. At the same time, I mean, like, I remember my wife and I experienced this. We were living in an apartment in downtown Dublin, and the power went out on our block on Halloween, and a bunch of the older neighbors who had, you know, lived in Irish villages and towns, but had moved into Dublin, they immediately said, "We've got to have someone watch the door because the young people are going to come in." They were, harkening back to an earlier time or something. But friends of mine who are in their 30s and 40s now would. You know, talk about how in their youth they can certainly remember going around and still tossing fireworks and things and lighting fires. That kind of tradition has lingered on.
All right, Tim, thanks a lot for sharing the story of Halloween with us.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Tim McMahon, Associate Professor of History at Marquette University and Vice President of the American Conference for Irish Studies. He joined us to talk about the roots of Halloween and how it became such a holiday here in the United States.
Coming up after the news, our guest says businesses and other organizations have a knack for hiring smart people and making them stupid. We'll hear from the author of The Stupidity Paradox coming up after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse represents what should be a safe district for Wisconsin Democrats. But as Hope Kerwin reports, Schilling is getting a lot of attention from Republicans as she prepares for a rematch with former Senator Dan Kopenke.
Democratic Senator Jennifer Schilling just finished her first full term representing the 32nd District in western Wisconsin. But Schilling is far from being a novice, serving as Senate Minority Leader for the last 2 years.
Certainly more of a statewide presence that I have taken the last couple years as being kind of the voice in the face of leadership of our caucus and making sure that I'm out there both with my legislative responsibilities, but also the campaign responsibilities fall to me.
Political science professor Joe Heim at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse says there's a lot of things about Schilling that make her a fairly safe candidate for re-election.
She's pretty well known in the district. She's well liked. She's run before, so she's a known quantity. You can't identify some votes or some things that she's made some major mistakes at. There's no personal gaffes of any kind.
Even with these advantages, this year's race is definitely not a normal election for Schilling.
It's a little bit like Back to the Future.
Former Republican Senator Dan Kopenke is back to challenge Schilling for his old seat. Kopenke represented the district for 6 years before being recalled over his support for Act 10, the controversial bill that all but eliminated collective bargaining rights for public employees. Kopenke lost the 2011 recall election to Schilling.
Some people from the other side, I think I even heard the senator say that, you know, this is a grudge match for me because I was taken out by her in 2011, and that's not the case at all.
But Heim says that's not the only reason Republicans in the state are paying attention to the 32nd district.
If you can knock off the leadership of the opponent party, you know, it's one of the major victories that you can have.
With Wisconsin Democrats looking to pick up seats in the Senate this November, Hines says Republicans could be looking for their own potential wins. There's some doubts as to whether an upset is truly possible. Hines says the most recent redistricting process gave incumbent legislators across the state sizable advantages against their opposing party.
To be blunt, what that means is most of the Democrats and most of the Republicans are safe in safe districts.
But Hines says Kopanky's role in this year's race has made it more competitive than normal, which could be enough to keep Schilling busy and unable to campaign for her fellow Democrats.
She cannot go running around all over the state to give speeches and try to raise money on behalf of other Democratic candidates. So this has an effect on the party overall.
Hines says there's also a possibility that Schilling will run for governor in 2018, another reason Republicans might want to knock her out of office. Asked about that possibility, Schilling says she never looks past the current election. And neither candidate has spent a lot of time talking about their previous race either. Tensions were high in 2011, and the state was as polarized as it had ever been. But Kopanky says that hasn't been the case this year.
It's been real civil out here relative to the 5 years ago when the recalls were taking place.
Schilling says she wasn't surprised to see Kopanky on the ballot, but she doesn't want to get caught up in the past.
I think the voters have a long memory.
It's hard to tell what's real and what's spin during political campaigns and whether a district is truly competitive or not. But interest groups on both sides of the aisle have bought campaign ads in the district. There's even been a radio ad against Schilling from a national Republican group.
Every vote was just another rung on the political ladder, all to advance Schilling's career at our expense.
These ads and Dan Kopanky's candidacy may not make a difference in a district that leans Democratic by the numbers, but they do have people paying attention to a race that might otherwise be an easy one for Democratic minority leader Jennifer Schilling. Hope Curran, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Veronica Rickert on Halloween.
That's right. And so we're going to ask you, throw the lines out to you for a few minutes, asking your favorite Halloween treat. Could be a packaged candy. What did you want to get in your basket when you're a kid? If you are a kid, if your kids are bringing home the stuff, what do you filch from their Halloween loot? Or what kind of homemade treats do you like to have? Even if you don't give them out at the door, is there a homemade treat that you have? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
That's right, and I have a no questions favorite every time. What I go for when the kids bring it home is the Reese's peanut butter cups.
And I wonder if that's the universal answer, because that's obviously mine, and I try to not buy so many to give away at home, because that's my favorite to eat, the Reese's peanut butter cup. Looking for your favorite Halloween treat now, 800-642-1234. And how much of a battle is it to not eat it all before the Halloween trick-or-treaters show up at your door? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 800-642-1234.
And I've conditioned my kids to be disappointed when they get the Swedish fish. And I know some people still give them out, but I always feel like that's a cop-out. Who really likes the Swedish fish? We tried them in Oreo form earlier this year. They were not even good in Oreo form. But some people must like them.
Things.
Who, if you're listening and you love Swedish fish, tell us why. What is it about the Swedish fish? Do you think it's okay to still give them out?
800-642-1234 is the number to call. Angela is starting us off in Gutenberg, is it? Angela or Gutenberg? I always have to think about that one.
It's Gutenberg.
Gutenberg, thank you. So what's your treat, Angela?
Kit Kat.
Why? And is that one, so do you buy that to give away, or is that too much temptation?
I have three little boys, so we tend to go after those after they come back from trick-or-treating. And actually, my kids call them kitty cats instead of Kit Kats.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. That was probably is a close number two for me. Angela, thanks a lot for that call.
That's a classic. All right. No Swedish fish, though. Now we're going to go next to Mike joining us in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You have no taste whatsoever. Ah. Like dark chocolate mounds washed down with a ice-cold Mexican Coke.
Oh, wow.
Whoa,
so you're
okay.
Really, you've got like a routine around the dark chocolate covered mounds. I don't know. I can't really argue with it. I'm not sure I want to try it. What do you like about it?
I don't know. It's just the old school Coca-Cola cuts the coconut just perfectly. So I'm telling you, dark chocolate mounds, I just...
I got Reese's Pieces thing. Just, I'm sorry.
Oh, not pieces. The cups. The cups.
Yeah,
you're
talking.
Gotta
be, well, you gotta
the
be
cups either. So it don't matter. It ain't dark chocolate mound, so it's not really that good.
Mike, I got to ask you. I'm getting suspicious here. Is this a Halloween tradition, or is this kind of a year-round thing for you?
Oh, this is year-round.
All right. Okay. I was kind of getting that feeling there. Plus the Mexican Coke, the real sugar.
It's got the real
People
sugar,
People say it's
I
different
guess.
Without the high fructose corn mm-hmm. syrup.
Rob, what do you give out at your home?
Oh, we've got a mix. We've got a big variety pack of one thing, some chocolates. There are some of the peanut butter cups for the temptation in our house, but not so much. So if they survive, then I'll eat them, but I'm not getting into beforehand. I think we take one more call before we get to our next guest. Michelle is with us in Green Bay. Michelle, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say that the worst candy is not Swedish fish, it's candy corn.
Well,
and
okay,
candy
I can
corn
see that.
should be taken off the market, should be outlawed, I'm not sure, but it's really, I don't know who eats that, but there are bags of it everywhere, and I'm just curious if everyone else agrees with me that it's the worst.
Yeah, you know, you raise a good point. I think that is a contender against the Swedish fish.
Sole choices, if I got to pick candy corn or Swedish fish, I'm going candy corn.
Yeah, me too. I will say that too.
But... I'm not putting either of them in my top 50 list, I'm guessing.
Right. I agree with that. They're good for decorating. I will say that. You can make little jagged teeth with them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing a few of your favorite Halloween candies. Keep messaging us on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we're just over a week away from Election Day. Wisconsin voters will be weighing in on national and statewide races and on local school referendums. We'll talk to a guest from the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance and find out why rural districts are going to the voters for more funding.
First, has your workplace ever sounded a little like the company in the movie Office Space?
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out. Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot. But it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo. Okay?
Yeah, no, I have the memo. I've got it. It's right.
There it is, a smart employee in a knowledgeable and rather a knowledge economy job, spending all of his time following mindless procedures. Our next guest says it's not just in the movies. Many organizations really do reinforce stupid, mindless behavior, even though they hire lots of smart, creative people.
Andre Spicer joins us now. He's professor of organizational behavior at Cass Business School, City University London. He's co-author of the new book, The Stupidity Paradox, The Power and Pitfalls of Functional Stupidity at Work. Andre, thanks so much for joining us today.
Word up.
Spell out, Andre, the stupidity paradox, if you will. An organization hires smart, often creative people, and then what happens on the job?
Well, what normally happens is that organizations want to look good, right? So they hire a lot of smart people who have, you know, very high IQs, and they also have great degrees from Ivy League schools. They get them into the job, and then guess what happens? They don't get them to think. So they basically encourage them not to use their mind. It's amazing.
And it's this amazing concept of functional stupidity you talk about. Functional stupidity, what is that?
So the idea with functional stupidity, so you get this image of the stupid worker at work, right? So it's the kind of Homer Simpson or the kind of Charlie Chaplin in modern times. You know, the guy's fooling around, making a lot of problems. But that's not the reality of stupidity these days in organizations. The reality is that you've actually got pretty smart people who know what's going on. And what then happens is that they go to work, they try and use their brains, they try and ask tough questions, make some comments, and their boss or even their coworkers actually say, hey, stop doing that, it's wasting our time, don't think about it, do about it. And guess what? These people are smart, so they don't ask those questions. They think, okay, if I want to get ahead in this kind of workplace, then guess what? I'm going to be pretty stupid as well.
And you write, this isn't just trivial. You, as one example, talk about the financial meltdown in 2008 of as an example of functional stupidity. You had these big banks. They were making money doing things, but it was all built on a lot of bad loans. People knew they were bad loans. The people who were asking the questions were basically told, as you're kind of saying, to shut up, making money in the short term. This really cost us, didn't it?
Well, it's not even that the people knew what was going on, right? So I work in the English version of Wall Street, so in the middle of the City of London. There's three big financial capitals in the world: Wall Street, the City of London, and Japan, in Tokyo. So I work in the middle of one of those, in London here. And if you go and speak with the people working in the banks, these people are really smart. They've hired quantum physicists, all of these really, really intelligent people, put them to work building all sorts of financial assets. And when you speak with these people and say, did you know what you were doing? They said, no one understood. No one knew what was going on. And that sort of was one of the greatest shocks of my life when I moved to start working in the City of London, that you realize no one knew what was going on. The regulator didn't know. The people designing these assets didn't know. The people investing the assets didn't know. And sure as hell, the people who were actually investing in them, you know, such as you and I and our pension plans, we had no bloody idea whatsoever.
So how do organizations get to this place where they're, you know, they keep doing what they've been doing because it works in the short run, but nobody is really making those fundamental or challenging those fundamental assumptions?
So what happens normally is so there's kind of three dynamics going on initially. So first of all, smart people realize when being smart doesn't pay off, so they switch off their brains. Second thing is that their coworkers begin to say, don't think too much, switch off the brain. Number three, their boss, right? Their boss begins thinking, okay, so this guy's creating too much trouble, stop it. And guess what? Their brains get switched off. So that kind of, they do it in the short term, and they get paid off for it, right? They get the promotions, they move up the hierarchy, everything's looking good for them. But in the long term, it begins to create problems because those smart people have seen the problems happening. They've seen what's going on, and then they haven't pointed it out. They know, okay, there's a problem which is going to occur here, but they've just sort of moved on from it. So as a result, these problems occur. So let me give you just one example. Is that
sure,
okay?
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay. So one example of this is Nokia, right? And Nokia used to be the world's biggest mobile phone maker, about 40% of the market in the world, this tiny Finnish company. You know, I think up in your part of the world, there's some Finnish people by background. Is that right?
Up north, especially, you bet.
Yeah, exactly. So these guys are ingenious. They know what to do, particularly when there's some snow and cold weather. So they think, okay, so let's start doing something. So they started making boots, and then they moved into making mobile phones eventually. They became the world's biggest mobile phone maker, and they kept on doing this. 40% of the market, but then Apple came out with the iPhone, and the iPhone was a big challenge. It was moving from just normal mobile phones to smartphones, and Nokia knew what was coming, but they didn't really question it. They didn't sort of think, okay, what are we going to do? And they had a mobile phone operating system they were developing, and everyone in the company knew this mobile phone operating system that Nokia was developing was rubbish. They kept on doing it, and they kept on doing it. All the middle managers kept on doing it. They knew it wasn't going to work. And no one pushed up the bad message because in that company, the main thing that you had to do was to be positive, to give a good message. And if you weren't positive, your division got closed down. So guess what? Everyone kept on pushing up this positive message, and the senior managers, people at the top, didn't realize the system they were developing just wasn't going to work. And 1 year down the track, Apple, Samsung, that overtaken Nokia by far. Nokia had fallen behind. And so if you look where these two companies are now, Samsung, Apple, number one and two mobile phone makers in the world, Nokia doesn't even make mobile phones.
Talking to Andre Spicer, co-author of the new book, The Stupidity Paradox. So, Andre, what is a company or a university or a school or whatever organization? You say this covers a lot of ground, The Stupidity Paradox.
Oh,
what
yeah.
can a company or organization do to, you use the phrase, I love this, de-stupidify?
Okay, so there's a few things we can do. Number one, we have lots of PAs, you know, personal assistants. Why not appoint a few DAs, devil's advocates? So these would be the people whose job it is to just say, I don't know about that, question it, ask some questions around it. There's a lot of psychological research that shows in a group, if you have someone who questions what's going on, they tend to take a longer time to come to a decision, but the decision they make at the end of the day is better. A second thing they could do is appoint some outsiders. So sometimes outsiders, whether that's new recruits or other people, come to it and they see a different perspective on the world. A third thing that we think that they could do is to engage in what we call pre-mortem. So, you know, post-mortem is that you look at the body when they die. The pre-mortem is that you look at what's going to go wrong before the body dies. So look at what's going to go wrong before the project dies. So it's pretty simple. So you begin a project, you get smart people around the table who have done it before, and you say, let's imagine in 2, 3, 4 years, this project has been a disaster. Things have been gone wrong big time. And then you ask them, what's gone wrong? And if you have smart people around the table, they'll sit and shake their heads and write down a long list of things that go wrong. You talk about it and you identify things and you say, how can we fix that? So this has two effects. Number one, it helps you to see around corners, identify what's going to go wrong. Number two, it helps you to basically say, it helps you to bring down your level of wishful thinking. Most of us think that a project is going to take half as long and cost half as much as it actually costs. I think the final thing you could do, I think, is that we need to change our culture. So you're still there, right?
Yep.
Okay. So we live in a stupidity oriented culture. I've been watching your presidential debates at 2 a.m. every morning here in London. I love it. But one of the things we could do is that we don't have enough time in our lives to think. The first thing we do when we face a moment to think is that we pick up our mobile phones, our smartphones, and look at them. The University of Virginia did an experiment recently where they said, just sit and think for 5 minutes to the experimental subjects, 100 people. Most people would prefer to sit and electrocute themselves rather than sit and think for 5 minutes. There was one guy who sat and electrocuted himself 100 times in 5 minutes. So I've started an experiment, and I would encourage your listeners there in Wisconsin to go out and do this as well, called pop-up philosophy. All you do, get a deck chair, go outside there in the cold winter, two deck chairs maybe, and put them down with a little board saying, pop-up philosophy, stop, sit down, and just think. And you'll be amazed the people who sit down and think. I've done this outside of the stock exchange, big banks, the parliament, and there's loads of people who just stop for 5 minutes and think for 5 minutes. It doesn't matter what they're thinking. You're just giving them a space to think about it for a second.
Have you worked with anybody to try to do that on an organizational level? Say, hey, investment firm, you need a thinking zone away from all the distractions?
No, it's a new idea.
Brand new.
Yeah, exactly. I've been doing it for the last 3 weeks. So I'd love to see what happens outside of my little world here in London. So if any of your listeners in Wisconsin want to find it, you know, want to do that, it's cheap. Just get two deck chairs or whatever, go out there, try it out, and see who stops and thinks.
And people are stopping and thinking along with you?
Exactly. So, for instance, I had hedge funders, I had startup tech firm people, I had some woman who ran a tourist photography business. I had the person who didn't stop was a homeless woman who came by and said, I don't have time for this, and then ran off.
Fair enough.
So, I think, honestly, the university is probably the major place this is needed. Sometimes we think that universities are like hyper-thinking spaces, but often people spend a lot more time thinking about, like, how do I get my next publication or whatever, rather than actually thinking.
Andre, you've given us a lot to think about. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Andre Spicer, co-author of the book, The Stupidity Paradox. He says businesses, universities, and other organizations practice functional stupidity. You can share your thoughts, maybe your experiences to the contrary, or experiences with the stupidity paradox itself. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page.
Wisconsin holds a new Guinness World Record thanks to the industrious people of Richland Center.
The record, the most carved Halloween pumpkins lined up in one place. The number, check it out, 3,975 pumpkins. As reported in the Wisconsin State Journal, that shattered the previous Guinness record of just over 2,000 pumpkins set by the city of Aniwa, Japan, last year.
And just as a point of comparison, Richland Center did almost 4,000 pumpkins with a population of about 5,000 people. Aniwa did 2,000 pumpkins, and that's a city of 70,000. So the pumpkin-to-person ratio in Richland Center is crazy off the charts.
I saw some pictures. It's a lot of pumpkins. And some more data. If you're not tired of hearing a lot of numbers thrown at you, the number of pumpkins carved at my house this year, zero.
Zero.
How did you do?
Four pumpkins carved. Yeah, and I am the reason it was not five. I prefer just to roast the seeds. I don't get into the carving. I like to look at them, but I'm into the seeds.
I did cook down a baking pumpkin yesterday and roasted the seeds. They came out really quite well this time. Sometimes those baking pumpkins, the seeds are a bit big and tough. Not this time.
Nice.
Did the job. But yeah, we're doing some Sharpie on a pumpkin at home.
Well, that counts.
The lazy household Halloween.
It all counts. Well, happy Pumpkin Day here on Central Time.